Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Welcome to Going in Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell, and my guest today is geophysicist and volcanologist, Dr. Jeffrey Zurich. But before we hop into the show, I do have a couple quick announcements. First, my book is on the way. Some of you may not know this, but like many of my guests, I have a pretty wild story myself. And I've seen through sharing it over the past several years that it can save lives, so I wrote a memoir. I'm currently working through 3 rounds of editing with my editor, and then it'll be out in the world. And if you want a quick overview of my story, you can go back and listen to the trailer for this show, or go to my website at zachtidwell.com to read about it. And while you're there, join my mailing list so you can get updates about the book and any other big announcements that I have moving forward. Finally, the best way to help this show grow outside of word of mouth is to follow, rate, and review it in whatever podcasting app you're using right now. Or if you're on YouTube, just subscribe to the show. And if you know someone you think I should talk to, have them send me an email at contact.goinginblind@gmail.com. Now here's the show. All right, we are back again. For everyone who's listening, we just had about the biggest series of hiccups possible trying to get this recording going and had actually gotten a couple minutes into it and then had to stop. So we're going to get back to where we were. Basically, I had mentioned I was just in Italy for the last week, and while Mount Etna erupted, and it felt to me like the universe was kind of aligning to have Jeff on, because Jeff is a volcanologist, and then all this happened and it seemed like everything was trying to go wrong at once. So Jeff, I think we were talking about, I had asked you if you were, you know, if you were a bright kid growing up, and if we could
get back into that.
Yeah,
absolutely. So I was definitely not considered a bright kid in the early grades of, what was it, nowadays in BC, that we would have called it emerging, which basically means you're in the lower third of the class. But, I don't know, something happened. I ended up getting a good teacher in grade 3 and also falling in love with science in general. Some people learn to, like, some people, like, I want to be an astronaut right from an early age, and then they actually stick with it. While for me, it was kind of volcanoes. Although, to be fair, dinosaurs was the first love. But being a hyperactive kid who couldn't sit still, and they take bones out of the ground with picks and toothbrushes very meticulously, I decided that was not for me. And volcanoes just was the next thing in. By grade 4, I was ready. I was set. I'm like, I'm going to study volcanoes.
Just so, that's so wild to me. You know, I went into the Marines straight out of high school, and I knew my entire life, even as a small child, that I was going to go into the military. I didn't know what branch, but it's not like, you know, you kind of just have to not be out of shape and not be disabled and not have a criminal record to go into the military. And you know, there's no, like, it's not a hard path to get there enlisting. So it's a very different ball game with, I'm sure, what the slog was of going all the way through and getting your PhD.
I think we should keep that in mind. Like, okay, if you really love something and you really want to do it, yeah, there's always going to be tough things that show up. But it's not necessarily like you feel you're climbing Everest or something like that, right? So in retrospect, yeah, there were certain courses that were really tough, but I didn't really feel like it was a slog. I pretty much enjoyed almost every minute of it. So I don't know. I don't think that's a fair comparison. At least
it's the role of passion, man. And it just, again, finding something that feels worth committing your entire self to makes the what becomes a grind for other people who don't want to be there is bad, then it's not so much of a grind, because it is, there's
exactly,
you always see that there's this, you see the light at the end of the tunnel the whole time, and it is, that means enough to you that all of the discomfort is worth it. But you know, I had mentioned during our first little recording here, when I have a very good friend who just finished her first year of her PhD program for psychology. And it sounds, I've always, I think anyone has great respect for anyone who reaches any sort of graduate degree, any sort of college degree in general, but obviously there's elevated respect up the farther on that you go. But and I always thought going down that path would suck from the investment standpoint, the time investment, and just the, you know, I love to learn specifically, like I've learned that I love to learn independently and through teaching myself. Like I've become a software developer since I lost my sight entirely by teaching myself how to code. And I now I'm very successful at it. But, you know, I don't like the classroom setting, but on top of that, hearing her discuss even what this first year has been like, and then, you know, what the next handful of years will look like, especially having the context that she does now, it just sounds like hell. And so it's, but because hers is a different pipeline, I really wanted to ask you what that, the schooling path was like. What did you do your undergrad studies in? And then in terms of
there's a lot to unpack there. Holy smokes. So first off, not all grad schools are the same, even in the same field. It comes down so much to the school and who your supervisor is. Mm-hmm. Your supervisor can change everything. And we can get into that as far as you want. But I mean, I got my bachelor's degree doing, it was more of a physics degree. It was physics and geology, a combined major. So geophysics. Okay. And unfortunately, I wasn't the top of the class for that because of the physics. I got really great grades in geology. Even the courses I didn't have the prerequisites for, I just found geology easy. But some of the physics, the higher level fourth year or third year math within the physics that they expected you to have because you were in physics, but you didn't have to take because you were in geophysics. Anyway, it created a lot of difficulties. So I got a couple of bad grades that brought down the average. So I knew I needed another way into grad school. So I didn't take a linear path, so to speak. So I had to first go to HVO, the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, and volunteered there and use that experience to get me into grad school.
And that was a deliberate decision to try and get that on.
That was a deliberate decision because I'd already done a volunteer stint there through co-op. So that's a program, many universities have it. I would say the engineers all across North America have to take it, where you spend a semester out of the every year essentially working in the industry, and it's almost like a course and you get credit for it. So I was able to use a volunteer stint at HBO during my undergrad, and then realized that my grades probably weren't good enough to just jump directly into grad school. This is a path for me to kind of sort of go in the back door.
Yeah. And so what all were you doing there? Were you actually, I mean, you had your, as a volunteer there, what was all that? It was basically just time doing the work that your degree was preparing you for?
Kind of. So the first time I was there, unfortunately, I should say that all the people at HBO then and today are fantastic. They're awesome people, great community. But when I was there the first time, I don't think they really knew what to do with me. So they kind of gave me some make-work projects. I was trying to do some basic coding on creating seismic alarms. So that the idea is once, if the ground is shaking to a certain amount, it will send an alarm to the individual researchers that need to get that alarm and then check the activity. But you also want to try to filter out things like wind noise, because one storm can come along and shake them. It shakes it differently than an earthquake, but enough to trip just a magnitude alarm. So basically what I was doing there didn't pan out to anything. The second time I went, I worked with the deformation group, and I came in with a little bit more experience because I'd also worked as a geophysicist in the field making money by the time I came back in. So then I was left to, or entrusted is probably the right word, to do surveys measuring the position of individual points within the caldera using GPS. And so if there's more magma into the system and it's becoming pressurized, the whole earth in that area will deform and move upwards. So I was allowed to go and just whenever I wanted to almost go and collect this data. So I was actually doing some of this baseline research the second time around. And I got to stay actually with who is now the scientist in charge or the chief scientist at, I think it's Menlo Park. He's the Yellowstone Observatory, Mike Poland. We went and camped on Pu'u'o, which is the vent Kilauea was erupting from the time, and sleeping in a tent with a gas mask beside you in case the wind blows the wrong way was kind of an interesting, it was an interesting night. But yeah, we were out there collecting deformation data, and it was a wild, wild time.
That's nuts. And so these aren't, I mean, it sounds like these seismic sensors are more permanent installations, but like what you guys were doing out there measuring to see if the earth is deforming is just kind of an impromptu thing where you go out and actively monitor it.
I mean, it's impromptu is the timing.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
That you go out or you can type or you can, but you they go and they set into the rock these monuments so that you go back to the exact same spot and you can line up exactly level your GPS perfectly. So you're trying to remove any possible error, right? Excuse me. So it is impromptu about when you go and do it. I mean, you can do it on a schedule, but I was just allowed to go do it because there was these transient events. Oh, now we're really getting technical.
I'm all about it, dude. Go for it.
So Kilauea, even today, seems to go through these events or pulses of magma into the system. And they'll inflate a little bit and deflate. Or in some cases, it looks like in the time that Pu'o was erupting, there would be a deflation. So less pressure at the summit as there's less magma coming from depth. And all of a sudden, it would inflate a little bit and then deflate. So it was a did or id events. And so when I was running out there to try to collect this data, it was to try to get these events in time, right? I'm providing more data than what they had because they have a series of permanent GPS base stations all over the place, but they're like one every, I don't know, 10 kilometers. I don't know. Some areas are denser than that and some areas have like none, because it's not safe necessarily to leave equipment there. So it doesn't cost you very much to sink these monuments in, and then you can just go hit them. And that's what I was trying to do. Hopefully that answered your question. I can't remember what the question was now.
I don't either. I'm just curious. I was asking if it was impromptu or if, you know, basically it was if these are permanent installations or if not. But in with that, can you guys predict those events happening, like, or that they will be coming along, or is it pretty much just erratic?
So I don't like the word predict in this particular instance. I think it's better to use the word forecast, because you think of a weather forecast, they're always giving you a percentage chance, you know? Yes, yeah. They also have a lot more data than we do as volcanologists, because they have access to the air.
Yes.
Whereas we're trying to access, okay, what's happening beneath our feet? And, you know, we have some ways to kind of sort of figure out what's down there, but it's not the same as directly measuring it. So we can forecast a volcanic activity based on what we're seeing, but it's not usually too far ahead of time. So a great example of this is the ongoing eruption activity of Kilauea. So there are certain patterns that show up, like I was talking about the deflation, inflation, deflation. I'm not 100% sure of the patterns that are showing up right now, but they're able to forecast the next episode in eruption of Kilauea right now within about 48 hours.
That's incredible.
But again, you know it's going to erupt. It has all of this activity, but now they're forecasting it within about 48 hours for these specific type of activity. Once that activity changes, then that paradigm gets thrown out and you have to go, you know, it's harder to figure out again.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like you mentioned, and likening it to a forecast as opposed to a prediction, because it sounds, and comparing that to a meteorologist predicting weather. I mean, all of these measurements are essentially just secondary effect measurements that you guys are able to take, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because we're not able to directly measure much, right? We're using seismic activity, so we can pick up the number of seismic events. The nature of those seismic events can tell us what's happening below, but it's not like we can measure pressure directly. It's not like we can measure temperature directly. And when we do measure chemistry, it's as it comes out instead of what it's like down below.
Yeah.
So we only have individual small pieces of the bigger puzzle.
I guess with that, like the gases and stuff that are being expelled, do they change as an eruption is coming?
Yes. So I think the best way to explain this is to think about, have you ever evaporated a thing of salt water, for instance?
Like
you got
to
those
distill
salt crystals.
Yeah,
you get the salt crystals and stuff. So if you have a bunch of different elements in that water, as you allow it to evaporate, different elements will come out in different salts at different times, depending on concentration. It reaches its saturation limit and then it starts to form crystals. So magma is kind of the same idea, but now we're going to kind of work in it a slightly different way. Instead of having it evaporate, instead we're reducing pressure. So as you reduce pressure on your magma body, the first gas that starts to really come off of it is carbon dioxide. And that comes off at about, I don't know, a couple kilometers or 5 kilometers beneath the Earth's surface. It starts to come out of solution, because all of this gas is in solution in the magma to begin with. You can think of it as your pop bottle, your Pepsi. All that carbon, all that fizziness is in solution when the cap is on. But as soon as you take that cap off, you reduce the pressure and that gas starts to bubble out. So deep within the ground, your CO2 starts to bubble out. As you get shallower and shallower, eventually you also have sulfur dioxide coming off, which is arguably the more dangerous of the gases that come out of a volcano. And that comes off fairly shallowly. So you can tell that the magma must be fairly shallow in the Earth's crust if you're starting to be able to measure SO2 at the Earth's surface. So it's not like there's different gases as it comes up. It's just they come out of solution at different levels.
Okay. And yeah, and so that's where you're able to detect changes, is in the balance between the different gases in that solution when they're coming up.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's so interesting.
But again, it has to be very close to eruption before you get a lot of SO2, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not going to, once you've got SO2, you'll be like, okay, so this is an active system that could erupt. You know, you're not saying a month out typically that, oh, I've got SO2, it'll erupt in a month. No. That means you have something shallow and it just has to destabilize a little further and then it can erupt.
Okay. So that was all while you were at the HVO, like all of this, basically what we've talked through up to this point, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm also imparting a bunch of other knowledge that I've learned along the way, but yeah, I getting that hands-on with an active system that is safe was absolutely amazing. Going out there and poking lava with a stick was so much fun. I can't describe it. I'm smiling now, even thinking about it. Cooking grilled cheese on a cooling lava flow, you know, stuff like that. It's just amazing. And then there's also the awe-inspiring just beauty of it. Cameras do poor justice to it. I wish I was there now to see the fountaining where it's throwing lava, like, what is it, 1,000 feet in the air in some of these episodes. It's just awe-inspiring. I just can't imagine what that'd be like at night.
And that's, I was, yeah, that was, it's funny that you mentioned that. That was going to be my next question, was like, are the, you know, how intense? Because even like seeing recordings of that stuff, even just the colors in the magma are, I mean, they're brilliantly colored even in recordings, but it's on another level when it's in person.
Yeah, I don't know. There's something to about the raw power when you're in front of it, right? I mean, there's only so much an image can do. I mean, you can also feel it. It's not all visual as well. Like the sound, the heat. Yeah, I've been in a few spots walking across flows where all of a sudden I go, yeah, nope. I can't get off of this because it's too hot.
That's scary. Yeah.
I wouldn't say I was ever scared, but I was certainly concerned, right? You're kind of like the spidey senses go up and you're like, this is probably not the greatest spot for me to stay.
Yeah. That's nuts. So as you kind of get all this time under your belt and you're able to start, I mean, this was a deliberate move so that you could get into grad school. And when you finally did, because at that point in pursuing a graduate degree, you're actually participating in research that will get published as well. So What was the shift there, and where did you end up? Because I'm assuming you had to relocate from Hawaii.
Yeah, it's funny how these things work out sometimes. I almost moved back. I can move back to my own province where I grew up. Not the same town, of course, because I grew up in a tiny little town of like 6,000 people. And I ended up moving to essentially Vancouver, British Columbia. So 3 million people. It was a big town to me. It's a big city to me. But it's just how things happen to line up. I didn't know where I was going to go at that point. I was going to take whatever I got. And I guess a retired or emeritus professor from Puget Sound University showed up trying to carry on one of his students who ended up tragically dying. I never got to meet him in a final destination, I guess, sort of way, due to a logging truck on a logging road. So he was trying to carry on this data set, and he came to HVO while I was there. And I already knew how to use a gravimeter from my time working as a geophysicist in Canada's Arctic. So I was just like, yeah, let's go, let's do this, and kind of took over and started doing it all, right? And he's talked to who became my PhD supervisor, Dr. Glenn Williams-Jones, is like, you got to take this kid. You got to do it. And I guess he just kept badgering him till the point where he's like, okay, fine. And then, so then I volunteered with his PhD student in Nicaragua, working on Masaya volcano for a few weeks. And from there, I was accepted into the program.
Have you been all over the world studying volcanoes?
No, sadly, I wish I was.
I was, so when you said that, I was like, oh, yeah.
I know. I got to see a fair bit of Nicaragua, and I got to do a little bit of work on the Cascades and Kilauea. I did get to travel to a conference in Japan. By the way, the only place I've ever had culture shock was Japan. I just did not know the rules of engagement there.
Very different there. Yeah. Very, very different.
Yeah. Nicaragua was fine. I quite enjoyed it there. There was the language barrier and things like that, but I wasn't feeling like I didn't know how to behave on the streets, right? Like I didn't feel like I was breaking faux pas everywhere. But in Japan, I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah. And I mean, so you had mentioned, like you highlighted that your program supervisor can have basically entirely dictate this path. And I got the impression that you might have some strong opinions there. What's the story?
Well, okay. Now, I actually, while being a graduate student, got involved with the Teaching Support Staff Union at my university, Simon Fraser University. So they represent, as a trade union, the teachers that are not faculty, essentially, which includes grad students. So grad students who TA and teach the labs, for instance, when they do that work, they fall underneath the union. And so I was with the union and started being on different committees like the grievance committee. And through that process, you end up hearing, I guess, all the dirt within the university and all the troubles that people have, sometimes of their own making, to be fair, but quite often because the supervisor probably never should have had students. And some of them are quite heartbreaking because this person has their career completely derailed and it was nothing to do with them. They just needed someone to be present because you're supposed to be, as a supervisor, kind of like the mentor, right?
Like a shepherd.
Yeah, like a shepherd. You said you personally have a hard time with the classroom, but by the time you get to grad school, there's usually a little bit of classes that you have to take. But if for those hard sciences, you're teaching it to yourself, but you don't know enough to know what avenues work and what avenues don't. And if someone's not there to shepherd you, you're going to spend the entire time reinventing the wheel.
As opposed to being told like where to look for these things and where to seek out this knowledge.
Yeah, it's not it really being told where to, but it's like guiding one to. Like yeah. you still want the master student or the PhD student to go down some dead ends. That's part of the learning. Know what you understand what you don't know, for instance. But you know, when you're going down, you're like, oh, wait, no, I've been down this road. You don't want to go down there. Here's the reasons why. Perhaps try something else, right? So when you don't have somebody there to try to help shepherd you, or you have a person who's just not able to work with other people, yet they need to work with other people, it really shuts everything down. And yeah, fundamentally, professors, when they want to have a continuing career, putting out paper after paper after paper after paper, the vast majority of those papers are coming from their graduate students.
It's just their names on it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this is a kind of a weird, you know, I've thought about this a lot, and it's obviously I'm an outsider, so I realize this is a very surface level, I don't even know if it's fair to say understanding, but surface level take on this and like the whole tenure system in universities, where I get the idea it feels a little dated to me that is still a thing, because it leaves the door so wide open for someone to take advantage of it and just phone it in once they have tenure, like it sounds like maybe some of these absentee supervisors do. And it's, you know, I don't know what you do to fix that other than just get rid of the tenure system. But I had heard someone talking about this. You know, I listen to a lot of podcasts being blind. I don't watch TV really, but I pretty much constantly, if I'm not working, have something that I'm listening to, either a book or a podcast. And I heard someone discussing this and basically laying out the idea, and I don't know how true this is, but that the tenure system initially was intended as a means for, okay, you know, you've earned this and now this kind of gives you the right to take chances and go into, you know, areas that might not be fully supported by people and just kind of, you know, explore as a scholar. And that, again, I'm sure a lot of people still use it that way, but then it does just, there's so much room for a turd to take advantage of that. And that's unfortunate when it is because of the way that this system works in terms of, you know, you rising to the ranks and becoming one of those scholars. I mean, yeah, you can ruin somebody's life.
For sure. And I don't think they need to get rid of the tenure program or a situation, but I do wish they would take procedures or steps towards like not allowing some people to have graduate students, because some of these people are great teachers. They just shouldn't have graduate students. Or some of these people are great researchers, but you know, maybe they are only allowed to have a couple students, or they must have a really good, strong, you know what I mean? Like there's ways of dealing with this without getting rid of the tenure situation. And yeah, to be fair, tenure is, I would say, fairly important. Even if you have tenure, if you don't show up for work to do the base level teaching, you can still get fired.
Okay.
So where it comes into play by mailing it in is that you get tenure. Now you have no grad students. Now you're only doing the base amount of teaching, just enough to not get fired. And it actually brings down your department as a whole. That's where it really becomes a problem, because then like you're never around, you're never on committees, you're never dealing with the bureaucraticness of running a department. So then it falls to everyone else in the department. And you know what I mean? Like you're just checked out. You're just not engaged.
And it's already a small, it's a small crew of people. Now you've got a weak link.
Exactly.
That is a huge leech. Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, there's some real critiques with the tenure system, but because the people who really don't like higher education are kind of funny because they also attack tenure. But fundamentally, I'm just going to use this. I don't care. The crackpots that are out there saying climate change doesn't exist and they have tenure, but their university can't get rid of them. You know what I mean? Like that exists to protect them as well.
Yeah. That makes sense what you said though about like limiting. Okay. Yeah. This
but
person
that's an institution
just...
thing, right? That's an institution thing. And the institution, unfortunately, oftentimes is run by a group of people that don't want to change. I know this firsthand from being part of the union where we are actually at the negotiating table with the university. And I don't know if I'm legally allowed to repeat some of the things I heard on the table, but they were gobsmacking coming from an academic institution. You're just like, what is going on? And of course, we're all graduate students sitting across the other side of the table, right? So we're like into math and physics and logic and piecing things together. And then you're getting this giggly goop of non-logic coming back at you from the institution you're going to. And you're like, oh my goodness, what is going on here? So you can imagine if that's applied to other parts of the institution, how hard it is to change, even when it is in their best interest.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said though. I mean, like you might be a great teacher or you might be a great researcher, but maybe you shouldn't be mentoring people. Those are three different skill sets.
Absolutely.
So, like, that totally makes sense. That's really interesting. And so did you end up doing teaching as well? Have you always gone down, or has it always been a different path for you?
Well, I as a graduate student, I got to teach several courses. They were all a couple of times, a 101, what do we call it? Death and destruction. For non-majors, talking about earth hazards, so earthquakes and volcanoes and big storms and that kind of stuff. It was a 100-level course. Yeah. Got to teach a bunch of labs, and I got to teach a fourth-year volcanology course as well. Last summer, I got to teach a field school because my past PhD supervisor was on sabbatical and they needed someone who knew geophysics. So I got to go up there and do it. It was great.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was awesome. I also had a couple of interviews to be a professor, one in Texas in Wichita Falls and one in Edmonton, but I unfortunately didn't get those positions. Hindsight being 2020, it's probably a good thing I didn't get the one in Texas given where my life was at that time, but that's neither here nor there.
Okay. And so, gosh, in its entirety, because, you know, like I know, like med students, for example, they finish medical school and then have to go do a residency for, you know, years. When in its entirety, your education path, how long, like grad school specifically, until you are a fully fledged geophysicist and volcanologist, what was that timeline like?
Yeah.
How long was it?
In North America, you usually do a 2-year master's and a 4-year PhD. Oftentimes, your master's and your PhD take longer than that. If you are one of those lucky, one of those individuals that actually skip the master's, then usually your PhD is just 5 years. Okay. And you're not really skipping. Usually you start as a master's and then you transition that into a PhD without actually completing the master's. Okay. So I did it in, I think I took 4.5 years for my PhD and 2+ a semester for my master's. And during that time, we had kids as well, 2 kids, which made things
more
difficult. I did end up taking, what was it called? Paternity leave for 4 months.
Okay. So were you married?
We technically common law.
Okay. So, wow. And so you finished
you
finished
again,
your
when you are getting, by no means were we getting a lot of money, but
yeah,
when you have enough to subsist off and you don't have any other hobbies, right? Like you have kids and the school, which you, or the project that you love, it, you can get it done. It, if it's one of those things that I tell people, if they were like, I want to go get a PhD. I'm like, okay, do you love it? Because if you don't love it, you're going to regret it. If you love it, go for it. Don't let anyone ever talk you out of it. But if you don't love it before going in, don't do it, because you're going to hate yourself.
That's funny you say that. So my friend that I had mentioned earlier, who's in our PhD program right now, had, when we were in Italy, had, we were at a pasta cooking class, and there were some two, I think, still undergrad college women there that she started talking to. And one of them was talking about, yeah, my long-term goal is to get the PhD in psychology. So they started talking about it, and my friend had sussed out that maybe it was just like a, you know, this sounds like a cool thing to do thing. And she was like, hold on, like, do you love research? And it went like, kind of like, no, not really. She's like, do you love research? Because if you do not, find something else to do. Like you just said, like
it's going to destroy you. Like that's just what it is. Unless you get really lucky with the project and the people. But I mean, that's like winning the lottery. You're better. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, and that's a big bet to take. Like, okay, yeah, well, like maybe I can get the ideal situation here, but that's,
yeah, yeah.
So,
don't do it.
Yeah, and I know you had mentioned, I believe this was right after you finished your degree, you had a hard time finding work, right?
Yeah. So after my PhD, and I managed to get a postdoc and trying to apply to become a professor, it was, once you have a PhD, you're kind of, in the eyes of most people, overqualified for things. And to be fair, I would say a lot of people who end up getting a PhD, or that I got a PhD with, they don't necessarily, like, it's a different skill set, right? So the way PhD tend to make decisions is quite a bit different than, say, those that are in business. And so there's this perception that we shouldn't hire you because you're not going to be able to make confident decisions or something like that. So it kind of goes two ways. Not only are you overqualified, but we're not sure that you're going to make timely decisions in our business apparatus to hire you at a position that's going to pay you what we think you probably deserve as a PhD. Did that make sense?
Do you think that's like them seeing you as being institutionalized, or just as a big brain kind of thing?
No, I don't think it's as institutionalized, but there is something to be said about the decision-making process to some extent. At least those from sciences that went through science properly, is that you're allowed to have doubt. And so unless I am 100% sure, I'm willing to stake my life on it, I'm going to use words that provide some wiggle room or doubt. Always. Mm-hmm. And it actually kind of drives people nuts. So in that process of trying to find work, I got passed up at least once, strictly because I have a PhD. And then we have something here in Canada called a professional designation for geoscientists, which includes geophysicists and engineers. We're all in the same group. And you need 5 years of work experience to be able to get it. So I had 1 year from before, in between getting enough money to go back to HVO. And then your degrees can count up to 2 years. So I had 3 years out of the 4 or 5 years I needed. So I couldn't even get a PGO. So now I've got a PhD, so I'm overqualified. But for the things that need a PGO, where the PhD might be useful, I need a PGO first. And so I got
stuck in this. That's a conundrum.
Yeah, I got stuck in this limbo. So I started putting out resumes to different places, and I put one out to, ended up being a good friend who owned a company. Of course, I didn't know him then. He calls me up and he's like, dude, do you actually want to work for me? And I'm like, I gave you a resume, didn't I? And so that job took me all over Canada, into the most rural places that Canada can provide. And I mean that, like, from well above the Arctic Circle, having to carry guns for polar bears, to being on the tundra, to being in the swamps of Manitoba and before that, while still working up in near Yellowknife, I ended up getting bit by so many black flies, a couple hundred bites on each leg. Never been so itchy in my life. So I've been to like these really rural places collecting geophysical data. That's what gave me the experience that I needed to get my PGO. And then once I got my PGO and life intervened, forcing me to find another job, I now have the job that I have now where I get to look at cool data, solve interesting problems, and all behind a desk, although I do miss the adventures.
And I want to come back to what you're doing now here in a second, but I guess when you're out there actually in the field working, how are you collecting these samples? Like, what is that? I'm picturing like surveying equipment.
Yeah. So I have listened to a bunch of your other episodes, and I heard you guys mention a couple of times fishing, like from Alaska. And I would say in a lot of ways, this is somewhat similar. The only difference is you're less likely to have to worry about being drowned, but it's not impossible.
Okay.
Because you're out there no matter what the weather is. You're carrying some instrumentation. Sometimes you're dragging wire, 60 pounds of wire on your back as you're hiking through the bush where there's no path, no nothing. You're just bushwhacking, laying out wire. So in the case of the wire, you're making a square loop of wire, which is, about 400 yards a side square, or they can be a lot bigger than that. They can be up to like 1,100 yards. Jeez. And you're sending a current along that wire. And that current goes on and off, like alternating current with a specific frequency. Now, electrical charge, when it moves, it's creating, it's changing by going on and off, on and off. Anything that is conductive nearby, or let me back up. Any times you have moving charge like that, where it goes on and off, you're going to create a varying magnetic field. And that varying magnetic field will go into the earth. And once it goes into the earth, anything conductive will take that varying magnetic field and have current within it. Now you turn off the current, and now that varying current within the ground starts to decay, starts to go away. And that's what you're actually measuring when you're doing time domain electromagnetism. So you lay out this wire. Sometimes it's in the middle of winter. Sometimes it's across frozen lakes at minus 30. Sometimes it's in summer and it's across swamps. And then as the wire is having the signal, you're walking across the topography, leveling this coil or this instrument, and then hitting buttons, and then repeat the process every 50 or 100 meters all day, every day, anywhere between 8 and 12 hours a day.
And so is it as the charge is decaying from these buried things in the earth,
you're able to detect the deposit that you're looking for.
Magnetic field that you left over from that you're detecting.
Yeah, exactly. And we're using that to try to back out what the conductivity of the earth is in different spots. So we're modeling the physics from that data to figure out where there are areas within the earth that are more conductive.
And is that how, I mean, on a larger scale, I'm assuming if you're looking for deposits of things, is it just more power that you're using? And like, what is the... Generally, I mean, how far into the ground are these things penetrating with these currents? Oh,
sure. It depends on the survey you use, but typically you're not looking deeper than about a kilometer.
That's still way deeper than I thought you were going to say off of.
It can be a lot less. It can be just a couple hundred meters. It's depending on the geology, the type of survey. So gravity, for instance, can see a lot deeper, but at the same time doesn't have the resolution. So it's like your pixels become very, very big the deeper you go, so you don't really get any fine detail. There's different techniques to look at different things. But when you're trying to look for a deposit, when you're using electromagnetism, then you're looking somewhere in the top kilometer, ideally top 400 meters, just if you want to make it economical and open a mine because of it.
That's so interesting. And I'd wanted to ask you about... oh my gosh, what is it? Is it woodridite? Is that the right? It's the mineral that they found that is essentially like storing water that they think
in the mantle.
So how the hell is something like that discovered? I know we initially The first time that was ever seen was from a meteorite, but how'd they find that in the Earth? Do you know?
I do not have the study directly in front of me. I do remember reading it, but I... So one of the things that they can do is they find it, okay, so in theory it should exist, and one of the things they can do is put it into a device that simulates the pressures and temperatures of the mantle and see what chemical or crystal structures are stable under those conditions. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure, without having the paper directly in front of me, that they either found it or they were able to recreate it. And based on the seismic and our understandings of how seismic waves propagate through that area, that this now explains it. You know what I mean? Like, because we can't go down there. It's so deep in the mantle. We're not going to get a direct sample from it.
Well, and that's, I feel like an idiot now, because I was trying to wrap my mind around, I'm like, how are you guys getting that deep and into that hot and that much pressure, but recreating it in the lab? I mean, that makes a lot more sense. It's still, I mean, has that, because, gosh, I don't even know what to ask about in terms of, is that anything that you research having to do with that? Or is that just kind of like a general thing that now you have to be aware of as you're studying seismic activity through the Earth to like try and map things out?
Oh, man. See, now we've gotten really specific. And so if I was dealing with mantle dynamics, particularly lower mantle dynamics, then this is something I should know. But if I'm that specialized, chances are I'm an academic institution and I'm not just a bachelor of science or maybe even a master's of science. I mean, I don't even need to do that as a volcanologist geophysicist, because I deal with things that are typically crustal or maybe just a little bit into the mantle where magma is actually created. I know about these sorts of things because I'm a science nerd and I try to follow it, and it's also the reason why I have a science podcast. So it's one of those things that I try to keep up on, but yeah.
And that is whimsical wavelengths, correct?
That's correct, because when you get down to it, no matter what you're measuring, it always comes down to wavelengths.
I love that. I have to admit, I totally forgot that you had mentioned that when we first got in contact, because it, you know, it's been a couple months, but that is something, you know, I reviewed my notes from that stuff yesterday and then again today, just to like make sure I had everything fresh in my mind again. I will be checking that out this week at some point. That I wish I would have remembered, because I would have listened to it on the plane to and from Italy, because I just had a lot of ass time sitting around. But I will absolutely be checking that out. But, and that's, I guess, the other thing, while we're on kind of odd specific things here, and then I want to kind of see what your work is like today. Just, I wanted to make sure that I didn't forget to ask you about the Woodwardite. And then, you know, I think it's this other thing. Basically, I believe I had first heard Elon Musk talking about this on a podcast. It was this idea of how dire things could get if our poles shift. And then in me trying to read about it, and you know, I've only,
oh my gosh,
me putting an hour and a half into looking into this stuff, I'm like, that doesn't necessarily seem representative of what I'm reading.
I can almost guarantee you whatever he said is not representative, or at least not the way people interpret it. So when there is actually a whole conspiracy side of things, that the poles are shifting, man, we're just going to go from up to down. And you're like, no. When we talk about pole shifting, we're talking about the magnetic poles, and we're not talking about the geographic poles. So first and foremost, let's get that out of the way. I'm sure you weren't confused by that, but I know, I've met quite a few crazies online, but they also say the Earth is flat. So there's that.
Are you hanging out on 4chan or what?
Oh, no, just Facebook.
Oh, okay. Specific corners of Facebook. Yeah,
the science pages where the crazies go to try to convince everyone else that their crazy ideas are right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens when you're trying to flog a science podcast on social media. But before we get sidetracked, what we're talking about here is, it seems like, at least in recent times, about every 700,000 years, the North Pole and the South Pole, geomagnetic north, that is, they flip or they weaken and move. With that, we don't have a full understanding about how this happens, but broadly, you have a liquid outer core and a solid inner core. and the two of them kind of sort of compete. So the inner core has something that's probably more stable, and the liquid outer core, which has moving ions, it can cause the inner core to flip every so often. We don't know what that process is like, but as that starts to happen, one thing that will definitely affect us here on Earth is that our magnetic field will begin to weaken. It will never fully shut off. It's not like we go to zero magnetic field and then all of a sudden we're open to all the cosmic rays of the universe and we're going to get cooked. But it'll be weaker and we will get more radiation to the Earth's surface. So that's bad from just like a cancer standpoint. But where it becomes really a problem for us modern humans is when the sun has a solar flare or an eruption from its surface and hits us directly with this solar flare and the eruption from it, then it can, with a reduced magnetic field for the Earth, then all of a sudden all our electronics are much more vulnerable. So that's where it becomes a real problem, and it should be, you know, someone hopefully, not me because this isn't my specialty, should be thinking about the engineering of protecting our vital systems that we've come to rely on as a modern world.
Yeah, which we already know. I mean, like America's grid for what is horrible and like not hardened against any of that stuff. And I think, you know, the solar flare thing is an interesting thing to me because it is scary. And I've thought about, you know, if something like that happens and there's like, which, you know, depending on how severe it is, it could wipe out basically all electronics. But like in some sort of event that causes anarchy to take place, like I'm kind of screwed. So being completely blind, like I have thought about that stuff, but it's just, it's so interesting. I didn't realize, I guess I thought that we were kind of screwed no matter what, if we got hit directly by a solar flare in terms of everything getting fried. But even in...
Well, it comes down to the size. We get hit by solar flares every year. Every year.
Really?
Every year. There's been lots of stories about the Aurora Borealis just last week being seen as far as what, Indiana or something or other. That's a solar flare. We get hit by them all the time. It's just, there has to be a certain size of solar flare. And yeah, you can argue we're overdue for one of a particular size, but I also think we're better prepared for it than people. Like, I don't know. I just get, we often think about, we get scared of something and chances are somebody else has already thought of it, right? Like there's people studying these things, right?
Yeah.
So somewhere there is somebody there, which is the reason why the movie Don't Look Up drove me nuts. But that's neither here nor there. So that means there's probably plans in place to try to bring everything back up online. Yeah, we're going to get screwed. Yeah, it's going to suck. But it's not going to be like back to the dark ages, no more electricity forever. You know, it's going to be this slow rollout as things get repaired and get put back into place, right? Like there are already thoughts and understandings about how to try to recover from these sorts of things. Now, whether or not our government apparatuses are going to be able to deal with that, that's a different story. But there's already people thinking about this. There's already plans been made somewhere that this is how we should respond to it, right?
Yeah, I don't, that's a tough one. And I'll try not get us like too weeded or bogged down in the weeds here, but like, you know, everything essentially, you know, virtually everything is digitized. And so like these flares would fry the chips that everything are onto. And I'm sure there's probably, you know, backups and hardened facilities somewhere, but it's just, I think it would be more than everything sucking. I think to an extent there would absolutely be a period of time where like we are set back, I don't know, maybe centuries?
No.
You don't think so?
Not centuries. No. Okay. Definitely not centuries. I mean, you look at it this way. Your phone is unlikely to have its chip fried from just being on during one of these. But anything connected to the grid might get fried. Because it all comes down to how big of a power surge. So the longer the wire, the more power surge you can have.
Yeah.
So things that are wireless devices can still fail. Just like anything we send out to outer space, we try to harden it for things like radioactivity so that way it doesn't fry the electronics, right? But even things that aren't hardened will survive in space for a certain amount of time, even in that environment. But it'll just degrade a lot faster. So yes, a bunch of handheld devices would fail, but it's not like everything would fail. It's just anything that's connected to those systems that are going to have these huge power spikes coming through them. And that's what's really going to destroy things. And yeah, that's going to bring down electricity everywhere for a while, because now all your transformers are blowing, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's going to be bad when it happens, but it's hundreds of years or back to the dark ages. I don't know. Only if we go to war because of it.
Which is also possible.
But, yeah, I know. Now that I said that, it's like, all it takes is one stupid person with a button, right? Oh my God, these people are attacking. Love sea missiles.
Yeah, dude. And that's I've been listening to this book. I wish I could remember the author's name, but it's called Nuclear War Scenario. And basically she did a whole deep dive into specifically, you know, it's the world's nuclear arsenals, but then specifically what the U.S., all the protocols and things that are in place in the U.S. and how bad things would get. I mean, I don't think anyone thinks that things would end up in a good spot if we got into like a nuclear war, but it's just, I don't know.
That would set us back hundreds of years.
Yeah. But we're just like right now, we're on such a weird spot in time. It feels like this is Cold War number two, but all the proxy wars and stuff going on. So I don't know, if we got hit with a flare, you could see somebody doing something stupid, but
for sure.
Out of the giant rabbit hole that I just kind of moved us into.
Hey, I helped you dig the hole, man.
Yeah, so sorry about that. That wasn't my intent, but this is how these conversations go. We've kind of covered what working in the field was like today. What are you, and I'm curious also, because you had mentioned earlier coding, and then I think you had hinted at it again when you were talking about some of the stuff that you do today. When you're talking about that, are you specifically like in database querying, like you're using like SQL and stuff like that, or are you actually writing scripts for things?
Coding is not one of my fortes, to be fair, but I do end up having to code because we have what we call inversion code. Somebody else has made it. And so what that does is it solves the physics from the data that I was talking about earlier. So you take all these measurements at different points along the earth, and then you put it into essentially a code that models it, much like we do modeling to predict anything, but solves the physics with the information you have to make a three-dimensional model of the Earth of the property you're looking at. So whether that's conductivity or density or magnetic susceptibility. And so what I'm doing is utilizing those codes to develop these 3D models. Sometimes you're getting data that's not in the proper format, and then you have to filter it or
parse it into what you need.
Right. And all that is coding, because you don't know what you're going to get, right? So I do have to code, and I do have to manipulate other people's code to be able to make whatever data set that I'm working. But fundamentally, most of the time, I'm just trying to cobble together the front end of the codes that I create to work with the back end, which is doing all the fancy physics.
Yeah.
And then I get to troubleshoot the data and the results and see if they make sense geologically before sending it to the client.
Do you enjoy it, or is this just kind of where you're at in your career?
I enjoy certain aspects of it, because some of it can be quite complicated. So one of the things, and probably the reason why I love the PhD, is that I like trying to solve problems and understand a particular system. And so every once in a while, we'll also get a project which takes multiple different data sets. Like, they'll give me the geology, they'll give me two different conductivity measurement types, and I'll combine all the data to try to pull out the most out of it. And sometimes that can be really powerful, where all of a sudden you have these features in the earth just kind of pop out of the model, and you're like, so that's what it looks like underneath the ground. And that process is really rewarding. Sometimes, unfortunately, it's just a bit of a troubleshooting plug and chug. Like, you're just trying to get to the final product to give to the client, which is super great. They need that information. It's super useful, but it's not quite the same satisfying feeling that I get when I do those type of projects.
So what exactly are you working on? These are like surveys for external
clients? Yeah, so somebody else other than me have hiked through the swamps to collect this data. And then that data is now arrived on my desk, and I get to do all the fun, more complex math and interpretation to that data that I couldn't do when I was collecting it because I was collecting it.
Yeah. And, but like, this is a basically like a, the company that you work for is contracted to do surveys on these places, essentially, is what this is?
No, we're contracted to do the, solve the physics to give them the model.
So what are these companies using the models for?
So they, now we're going to get into a, there's no other way to explain this other than to get into some of the, my poorly understood financials behind the industry. So mining companies, junior mining, they're all about raising money. And they raise money by drilling holes into the earth and showing, look, there's some shiny rocks here. Give us more money and maybe we can have a mine. It's basically a stock market lottery system. You know, you put money into these little tiny companies, they spend the money, and if they end up making a mine or selling to a bigger company, you get paid out.
Yeah, it's all venture funding.
Yeah, but they did this type of thing even before venture capital was quite the same as it is today.
Okay.
So the only way to raise money is to drill, but drilling costs a hell of a lot of money. And geophysics is cheaper. And if you miss less often, you can raise more money to keep drilling and keep employed, and maybe you'll strike it rich, and maybe your shareholders will strike it rich, right? Like, that's how this works. And so we give them a model that shows where the, let's say they're looking for, they're looking for something conductive. So we give them a model and we say, okay, there's a linear feature here. It seems to be cut by a fault here. So it probably might be, or it, there's a possibility that it's been moved down into the left. And they go, ah, move down into the left, target the drill there. And the idea is that then they hit the deposit instead of missing the deposit, and allows them to begin the cycle anew.
That's so, and wow. So you guys, I'm, the fact that you can extract that from that data. I know it's this incredibly powerful modeling software, but you guys can, you know, make at least some guesses on that, some educated guesses on that stuff is insane. Are you actually able to, and it sounds like you might, like you can, but as you're modeling all this stuff, do you, like, do you, on a screen, do you get a 3D model of this stuff that you can analyze visually?
Wow. That's the whole point. So you put it into a three-dimensional, it's like a, you can think of a mesh or a grid, but now propagate it with depth, right?
Yeah.
So that's essentially what it kind of looks like, with each square of the mesh in 3D having a different color. And then you have a bar to the side telling you what that color corresponds to is conductivity. And then you have different sliders and things that you can move around. You can say, okay, in this entire model, only show me areas with conductivity over X. And then boom, then you see all the areas. And if they form up along a nice linear structure, you're like, okay, well, that's what the target is. And then if you start adding geology knowledge to it, then you can start to describe and interpret a little bit more what's going on.
That has to just be... That sounds so fascinating. Like, I would love to just get to kind of stand over your shoulder and watch you do this. Obviously, I don't know.
Unfortunately, normally I just get to produce the model and I leave it to the exploration team to make those decisions. And the reason is for our company, we don't want to be necessarily telling them exactly where to drill, because if they miss, we could be liable.
Oh, so it's this weird kind of legal dance, like,
yeah, to some extent, yeah. But you know, I still get the, I can still do all of those processes in my own head, as long as I don't officially communicate it to the client, then we're in the clear, right?
Yeah,
I can still pull apart the geology of the system as long as I don't tell them exactly where something is. And to be fair, inversions are in, you may be solving the physics, but they are also they're not unique. There's an infinite number of solutions that can solve the same set of data set, which is why you want to bring in things like geologic knowledge to limit the number of solutions, because only so many are actually geologically reasonable.
Hmm. To kind of suss out what is maybe artifact and what's not.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hmm. Dude, that is so, I mean, I'm trying to wrap my head around it without having any, like, I understand what you're saying, but trying to, like, picture what it would be like to be analyzing that stuff in your own head and, you know, not having knowledge of any of the geology kind of stuff. It's kind of mesmerizing. And it seems like it would be, because you can actually, you get to visualize what you're doing, like it would be very rewarding.
Yeah, it can be, especially when you have that geology information. Sometimes we just get a survey, and if I want to go do that, then I have to spend a couple of extra hours of research on my own time to figure out, okay, where in the earth, in the world is it? What kind of system is it? Whereas I'm only actually required to give them a model. But like, again, sometimes you get those complex problems where you're putting in that geology, and those are the projects that every once in a while I get to do that I really enjoy.
Mm. And so, like, if you nerd out on that stuff, I would imagine, like, for you, like, Mount Etna just happened. Is that an exciting thing for volcanologists where you're like, oh, now I can dig in? I would imagine you guys have access to these, you know, worldwide databases of all this stuff. Or
you would hope. In the case of Italy, and that's the case actually in a lot of places, let me just be first and foremost, the USGS is fantastic. They really allow their data sets to be able to be looked at by everyone, including, you don't have to be a volcanologist to go look at the deformation of Kilauea. They're so transparent in comparison to places like Italy, where it's not easy to get that information, even if you're a volcanologist, because there's something to do with the politics and stuff. So unless you have an in there already, you know someone, or you're Italian, like, don't bother trying to study Italian volcanoes. Just don't do it, because you're not going to be welcomed, essentially, is what it comes down to. And there are caveats, there's nuance here. It's not 100% that, but it becomes very difficult. It's more opaque. I don't know.
That's kind of mind-blowing to me, because you would think, scholars, you would want to do anything not to stifle that process.
I know. It's a whole can of worms. It drives me nuts. But people, academics are still people, right? And so often I feel like just even conspiracy theories about things that are in the science sphere. And you're like, wait, why are you going down this road? Can't we just like sum it all up to like people are people? Like, what the heck? Like, Nikola Tesla is a great example. An absolute genius, but a weird dude with all kinds of like issues personally.
You got to be a little eccentric when you're that smart.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. But all the things that he said that were patently false at the time, why can't you just chop that up to being him just being a person, right?
Yeah.
Like, dude, he's just a weird dude. Yeah, he was super smart. He pushed the boundaries of engineering and science in so many different ways. But he also thought we could get electricity for free from long wavelength radiation, which is just false. And we can prove it with physics today. But he's allowed to believe that. He's a person. It doesn't make him right.
Yeah, I think some of that, I mean, you know, on some scales, I mean, we know conspiracies do happen, but...
But those aren't conspiracy theories. Those are different. I would argue there is not a single conspiracy theory that has ever been proven true after the fact. A conspiracy theory is always something that we, in retrospect, fit to our preconceived ideas and notions.
Yeah, I believe that term actually came from, I think it might have been the CIA. Again, this is me hearing it. I haven't looked into the origin of the phrase conspiracy theory, but it as like a means of devalue, I guess, discrediting almost. I think a lot of outside of the, like, yes, conspiracies do happen. I think these wild theories like flat earthers is people having too much time on their hand, and sometimes it's also mental illness, you know.
No, for sure. But you see it every day, and I see it's hard for me being so into science and data. Like, you got to start with the observations. If you can't explain the observations with your current idea or hypothesis, you need to change your idea or hypothesis. That's how it works. That's the scientific method. But we're having a significant amount of people who are willing to stand on street corners and tell people, wake up, there's no issue with the long-term climate. And I'm going, wait a minute. where are you getting this from? And then they give a whole bunch of reasons, but none of them make any sense. And I don't quite understand why it's gotten to a point where this type of thing is now an identity issue instead of just like, this is the observations. Why can't we just move forward?
Yeah, I wonder how much of it is.
And I'm not getting into any of the alarmist things or anything. Like, we can talk about that. That's all political to some extent. But if we can't start with like, this is the observation, what are we going to do about it? And nothing is a choice. That's a political choice we can make. But let's start with what the observation is and then try to discuss what to do about it, right?
Yeah, and I think with the idea, it becoming an identity issue is because it does get attached to politics. And like, we have a problem with that with so many things where it's like, these should be nonpartisan issues that everyone can agree on as an issue. But for some reason, it seems to get attached to one side and said this, so then you have to be against it if you're on the other side, you know, in a very oversimplified way. And
but that's what it seems like. And even here in Canada, where we're not quite as polarized, you still see it. You still see it as like an identity thing. You're like, what?
Huh? And that comes back to the flaws of people. Like, we're tribal, yeah. Weird. That is a weird... The tribal aspect of people is a weird thing that is still, I don't know that will ever go away because it does seem to be human nature, but.
It will never go away, but I just, maybe I'm just too optimistic when I look at the world and figure that, you know, we'll do right eventually.
Yeah, I think, honestly, I feel like the biggest issue, there's a lot of people think for themselves is really the issue. Like, you can be, like, they're not really forming their own thoughts and opinions on things. They're just reiterating and magnifying someone else's words. And that's, I don't know. I'm sure if you're a researcher in that field right now, it's got to be an interesting time, like in social dynamics. But I guess.
Yeah, I interviewed someone from the NOAA. And after listening to the interview afterwards, it sounded fine, but maybe because of the video, maybe because of there was the impending job losses. it felt like doom and gloom kind of while I was doing the interview, but hearing it afterwards, it wasn't so bad. I don't know. Maybe it was also my perception I was putting on it and not anything else.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I've noticed with these even, I think I have a different filter for it. Like, I feel when I'm done with these recordings, I'm always like, oh my God, I did a horrible job. And then, like, you know, when the episode comes out, with something like this, like when I have someone who's an expert in a field, I want to go back and listen to it just, you know, to get the knowledge again and reabsorb it and be just listening instead of having the conversation. And then when I hear it, I'm like, okay, that wasn't that of... I don't know how much of it is because you know other people are going to hear it. And so you're kind of, you have that in the back of your mind, like, okay, this isn't going the way that I thought it would or whatever. It's a weird, the podcasting thing is a weird one. And you're still pretty early on in it too, aren't you?
Yeah. I just finished episode 20.
Okay. Yeah. So I think this will be 39-ish. So I'm like, right, our same area still.
I think we started at about the same time. I put out every 2 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. And I do five a month. So that would make sense. But
yeah.
What else is there? I feel like I've hit everything that I really wanted to ask you about, but what else?
Well, maybe I'll leave you with one scientific story that I'm going to be working on in the next couple of years. It's pertaining to the US and it's if my hypothesis is correct, it's actually an amazing story. You ready? I'll try to do it real quick.
No, dude, you can take your time because that was going to be my last thing. It was like, what is exciting you right now that like I haven't asked about? So this is perfect.
So one of the processes of trying, in the process of trying to prepare for the interview that I had in Wichita Falls was like, put together a scientific research kind of portfolio that you would do here at this institution. And 8-hour drive away is the Rio Grande Rift. And I started to look at it and I found this, stumbled across via Google Earth, the Carrizozo lava flow. It's the longest lava flow within the continental US at 75-ish kilometers long. I don't know what that is in miles off the top of my head, but it's the longest one. It's absolutely enormous. It erupted about 4.4 cubic kilometers of material. I know I should be talking in miles, but if you look at the 36-year eruption from Pu'o and Kilauea, it erupted for 36 years total and only erupted about 3.4 cubic kilometers. So this is a lot of material. The problem is that, or I should say, my hypothesis comes in because the current published research suggests that this eruption took place over three decades, much like Hawaii. However, my hypothesis is that this probably took place in the course of a year. Now, it's in a rural part. If you don't have a city underneath it, the lava flow is not really an issue. I mean, you can move people out of the way. It's not death and destruction. However, when you're putting out that much magma onto the Earth's surface and forming these lava flows, as we previously discussed, that magma has gas in it. And yes, CO2 and SO2 are the two, and water are the three big ones, but there's also chlorine and fluorine gas as well. And if you're erupting this amount of material in a very short period of time, everything downwind in that area is going to be absolutely poisoned by all of this volcanic gas coming out. And the only example we have of something similar, even though it is almost three times larger, was the Icelandic eruption of Laki in 1773, which erupted three times that of what Carrizozo did, about 14 and a bit cubic kilometers, and it killed 80% of all livestock on Iceland due to fluoride poisoning of all the vegetation, killed 20% of all the people due to famine, and then that volcanic smog drifted out over top of Europe and caused climate havoc, as well as you just have all that pollution. And so you have people out because farming was the big thing back then. That's how everyone was employed. So summer, working in the fields under this pollution, and you had tens of thousands of excess death in that year because of the pollution. And why do we know this? Because the Brits are amazing at bureaucracy even way back then. We have death certificates. It's amazing.
That's why they were running the world back then. Yeah,
exactly. They had bureaucracy and they gave it to all of us. So you have this eruption that in the Rio Grande Rift, right in the middle of North America, where the North American plate is slowly pulling itself apart as one part rotates away from another. And it will have another volcanic eruption again. I'm not saying it's going to be 4 cubic kilometers of material all at once, but there is a very large magma body, and I'm going to mispronounce this name, right near the town of Saqqaro, and they call it the Saqqaro magma body, and it's quite large, and this would be potentially the magma body you would tap to be able to erupt a very large amount of material in a very short period of time. And perhaps these sorts of things are more common than we give them credit to in the geological record, because the geological record doesn't give us this kind of granularity of being able to time out when individual events happen in a volcanic eruption, because radiometric dating isn't that precise. We're not getting down to the year, we're getting down to many decades or hundreds of years, right?
Very large ballpark window.
Yeah, ballpark from the human standpoint, but not necessarily ballpark from a Earth's age standpoint. Yeah,
yeah. Okay. What was it? Because you said you're leading this, right? Or this has been your own independent research?
So I needed to develop like a plan to do research.
Oh,
and then, of course,
for
I then didn't get the position.
Yeah.
And so I'm still here in Vancouver. My PhD supervisor still a scientist leading a group, and I eventually convinced him to put it into his research grant. And so in the next year, we're going to start getting students, and I'm going to be, I guess, a co-PI or something or other. I'm just in it for the fun of it, of course, because I think it's a fascinating project, and I'm really excited to tell that story first as like a scientific story. And then since I've got the podcast, I can also kind of go through the sausage making of how all of that came together to tell the whole story.
That would be awesome, getting to hear like the full drawn out. I guess, what was it for you to come up even with that, you know, this, to present that? What was it that keyed you in on that? Had you had that just sitting in your mind for a long time, or
Oh man, if you search my name on the Google web, you will eventually stumble across a business I tried to start up called Eggheads Consulting. And
I love that name.
It's funny because in other languages, eggs are like your balls, right? So it's very different connotation than what we would in English, but that's neither here nor there. It was because I live in like Hollywood North, the idea was because this was in the time where I didn't really have a job, I was hustling. So we were going to sell our academic knowledge to TV North. And throughout that, there was also some talk with different people with like a high wire act of like going over Urta Alley on a wire to over top of an active lava lake. There was all these weird discussions that I was a part of. And so wanting to tell scientific stories and get into that kind of started there, I guess, and just percolated over the pandemic. And then I found a job that I could actually do something like that with in my spare time, instead of never knowing where I'm going to be and when I'm going to be and what temperature it's going to be.
Wow, that's got to be so cool to know that that's coming full circle, though.
Yeah, it's exciting. I just got to stick with it. And sometimes that's hard. As you know, doing the podcast, sometimes you don't get a lot of feedback and you don't know whether or not you're doing something good. You know, people are listening to it, but sometimes you're just like, what am I doing?
Yeah, it's hard. And especially, I mean, this is, do you do any solo episodes or are they all interviews?
No, I do some solo episodes. So okay. I did more in the beginning as I was trying to find my feet, because I pre-recorded a bunch to like stay ahead of the content crushing machine.
Yes.
I've kind of fallen behind. I think I'm going to have to take a short summer hiatus to reset. But I did one on my own paper in Hawaii, looking at Mauna Loa. That was a solo one. I looked at how the Mediterranean Sea completely disappeared almost anyway, about 5.6 million years ago. Basically almost all evaporated away. So I did that one as a solo one. I did one on a couple on Nikola Tesla as a solo, but generally speaking, of the more technical I get, I try to bring in a guest. Because I don't know much about gravitational lensing, for instance, or how insects breathe, which I never thought about until someone introduced me to Dr. Holster. And I was like, hey, actually, I've never thought of this before. How do they breathe?
I'm excited to check it out. But and that's why I had asked that was like, you know, on one hand, the learning to, you know, I've done a lot of podcasts as a guest, but learning how to lead the conversation is a totally different skill, and it's hard. And so like with coming back to you mentioning like, okay, I don't know how I'm doing, but if you're doing solos too, that is also another skill set to be able to monologue like that.
The solo one is a little easier for me though, as a teacher, right? You're always used to going up there and just kind of going. Usually you get more feedback than you would in a podcast in real time. But in a lot of ways it's the same, because I would tell a joke in class of like 300 people and you could hear a pin drop. And I don't know if it's because it was like, they don't know if they can laugh at me. They don't know. They don't have like the social, permission, or they don't get the joke, or if I just dated myself with my cultural reference. Like I don't really know. And so there was a couple of times where I just kind of stop and be like, okay, I know that was bad. I at least expected a few groans, and then everyone would start laughing. So I'm not really sure if they just needed that permission or what. So I actually do that a lot at the beginning of my podcast, throw in these terrible dad jokes. And everyone who comes on, every researcher that comes on, has to tell at the very last question their favorite science joke. That's how I end every episode.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. I love a good dad joke. It's funny. I have a pretty dark sense of humor, and sometimes I'll say stuff in front of people where like, I think I know everyone that's around when I say it. And so it's like people that I think will think it's funny, but then there's other people there that I didn't realize were there, and it'll just be silence, and not being able to see the facial expressions or like the I'm disappointed in you look on top of that joke didn't land is, it's horrible, but that's really cool, man. I guess with you, I'm excited to check out your podcast and definitely see what comes of you kind of documenting this giant research project and But
yeah, it's a little ways down the road yet. We still don't have the students in place. So I'm going to just keep going for now.
Is there any sort of grasp on what the time span would be for this thing to actually take place once it's up and running?
Well, you figure it's going to happen over the course of a PhD. So that would be kind of, the research is going to be probably about 3 years, you think about it. Because the last year is usually you're writing your dissertation. So it's going to be kind of 3 years-ish, and we don't have any students. And because Dr. Glenn Williams-Jones is on sabbatical in France, enjoying the high life.
I was about to say, what a hard life. Sabbatical.
To be fair, he's awesome and he's always available. He's probably works more than most people do at their 9-to-5, but he loves it. So it's not work for him, right? It's one of those things.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, I guess as we kind of wrap things up here, before I have you kind of plug anything that you want to plug, since you just brought it up, what is your favorite science joke?
Well, I think if I'm going to use one on your podcast, I'll make sure it's something that you will find funny and theming with your coding will perfectly understand. So why was the computer programmer terrible gardener?
Why?
Because he didn't have root access.
There we go. Little developer joke for everyone at home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, where outside of Whimsical Wavelengths, which is that kind of available everywhere?
Yeah, it's all major podcasting. In fact, okay. You use the same podcasting host as I do, RSS.
Nice.
So it's everywhere, Apple, Spotify, the whole nine yards. Just look up Whimsical Wavelengths everywhere it's found.
Awesome. Where else should people be looking for you?
If they want to catch me on social media, then I have an Instagram account, Whimsical Wavelength, same with Facebook, and Blue Sky.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on, man. And
it's been a pleasure.
Breaking things down into terms that a Neanderthal can understand.
You give yourself too little credit.
All right. And thanks everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Please rate and review the show wherever you listen, and then share this around with a curious mind who needs to hear it.